This is Radio Time. I'm Marty Moscoen. There has been long-standing interest in Maya civilization inspired by the magnificent ruins, archaeological finds, and its advanced culture. There's even more hoopla this year because of the Maya calendar and the end of its 5,124-year-long creation cycle that ends in December. While conspiracy theorists are predicting some form of apocalypse at the end of 2012, Maya scholars say the calendar is more about beginnings than endings. The University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology is launching an exhibit this Saturday that explores the fascination with the Maya calendar and culture and our current and very American obsession with end-of-world scenarios. Maya 2012 runs through January 13th, 2013, so I guess the world is not going to end this year. We have three Maya experts who have joined us on Radio Times. Let me introduce them to you. The first two join us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Loa Traxler is Associate Deputy Director of the Penn Museum, curator of the museum's new Maya exhibit. She's co-author of a book called The Ancient Maya. She's an archaeologist who was excavated at the site of Copan. And Loa Traxler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure.
Also with us is Simon Martin, Associate Curator in the Penn Museum's American Section, an ancient writing specialist, co-curator of this Maya exhibit. And Simon Martin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And joining us by telephone is Anthony Avini, the Russell Colgate Professor of Astronomy, Anthropology, and Native American Studies at Colgate University, wrote a book called The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012. And Anthony Avini, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be with you in spirit, Marty.
Indeed, spirit and in voice. Loa, let me begin with you, and we talk about the end of this Mayan civilization. Do Maya still exist, Maya people?
Absolutely, and one of the messages that we hope the public will really gain from coming and visiting this exhibit at the Penn Museum is an appreciation for the fact that we have millions of Maya who are part of our global world today, and they live throughout Mexico and Central America, and they're very much a part of this story. So the exhibition gives our visitors a chance to not only appreciate and really come and encounter ancient Maya civilization, but to also meet and hear from and engage with contemporary Maya throughout the Americas.
And Simon, living all over the world?
Yeah, a lot of Maya living right here in the U.S. There's been movements of people, for a long period of time. But, very strong culture to this day in Central America.
Well, let me turn to you, Tony Avini. And as I said in my introduction, a lot of hoopla this year about this Maya calendar, predicting, as some people would say, the end of the world, some kind of Armageddon. Is this really what the Maya calendar says, or is this what Americans, I guess, bring to this calendar?
Well, I think it's very much part of our romance with the Maya. That, and I might add that it's either an apocalypse or a kind of a bliss out, because the New Age people have got hold of this. Whether it's Armageddon or Rapture, the whole thing is biblical, and I think it comes from really deeply rooted in American religion. As far as the Maya are concerned, they say little or nothing about what's going to happen with this calendrical turnover. A colleague of mine who works down there intimately with them actually was approached by a Maya shaman who asked him, what's with you Americans and this fascination with our end of the world? It's not going to happen.
So why do you, this is a very global question to you, Tony, but why do you think Americans are so obsessed with the end of the world? It seems like such a gloomy worldview.
Well, Columbus said that, in his diaries that on this new heaven and earth that the Lord made and that St. John wrote about, he said that I am the messenger. God has showed me the way to bring the city of Zion down to earth. The American religion has this long tradition of a second coming. It's deeply rooted in Protestantism. It starts with the Puritans, Cotton Mather and the like, who talk about the imminent descent of Jesus to earth. That now plays out in the modern age with, Mexican deities like Quetzalcoatl descending from heaven. We're looking for answers to our problems in these exotic cultures. And, of course, it comes at a time when we're rather fear-racked with all the things that have gone
Indeed.
On in this new millennium.
But are you here to tell us that the Maya calendar does not predict the end of the world at the end of this year?
It most certainly does not. The cycle turns over, and a new cycle will begin. And this is very clearly rooted in the Maya writing, as I'm sure my colleague Simon can attest.
Well, go ahead. Attest away, Simon.
Well, I suppose one of the key facts is that the Maya calendar is very, very long. It has many, many places. In fact, it's a place notation system called the long count. There's regularly five places to that. But in fact, there are 19 higher ones. And these are all set at the number 13 at the moment. So if we add up all those number of days, we're going back trillions upon trillions upon trillions of years since the Maya universe began in its kind of original calendrical sense. So the period we're talking about is just the tiniest fraction of Maya time.
But as I said in the introduction, it's a creation cycle. What does that mean?
Well, some of that is just interpretation. What we know is that back in 3114 BC, the Maya perceived that there was a kind of reordering of the universe. That took place on a date which in their terms was 13000. And that date recurs come December of 2012.
Right.
So that's the kind of calendrical ancient Maya case for something happening.
But something could be something good, could be something benign.
Well, the issue is it's become kind of glommed on to a series of other ideas.
Right.
There's a very important Maya text recorded in the colonial period called the Popol Vuh. And that talks about cyclical destructions of the earth, that man is made first in the form of animals, and that fails, and the gods cast them out to the forest. Then man is made of mud, but, you know, the rain comes and they crumble away, they're no good. They make people out of wood, but their big crime is that they forget their makers. They don't appreciate that they've been created, and so they're destroyed in this sort of horrible cataclysm. And then finally, we are the people of maize. We're the people made out of maize dough, which makes sense if you're a Maya and that's your
corn.
Subsistence, the corn, indeed. So we're kind of perfect. You know, in Maya terms, you know, we've reached the end point of the God's idea of the perfect human.
Let me turn back to you just to put some of this into context, Loa, in terms of understanding this culture and how they viewed the universe and even thought about this notion of time.
Well, and indeed, as Simon mentioned, that sense that humanity on the earth today were very much made of the perfect material maize, and therefore the ideas of apocalyptic premonitions and end of time, those really, as Tony mentioned, come from different sources and are tacked onto a very ancient calendar tradition. But part of where we're delighted is that the interest and all of the attention being shown to Maya civilization in our own calendar year in the Gregorian system of 2012, that gives us a real opportunity to open up the conversation about so much more from ancient and contemporary Maya times. So Maya civilization, which excelled in all areas of sophisticated mathematics and engineering, amazing naked eye observation of celestial movements, all of that was within a context of an amazingly rich, multi-layered worldview. Mm-hmm. And part of where our exhibition is able to really bring people along is focusing on the figures of the kings of ancient Maya kingdoms who presented themselves as lords of time. And as Simon has discussed in many, many places, the role of those kings was really an embodiment, a representation of units of time often associated with their calendar day, Ahau, which is Mayan for lord. And so a Maya king who was really the center of his kingdom and community was also the anchor and the pivot of the cosmos. And so all of these ideas about how the world is maintained in proper order, how a king would represent and interact with the supernatural worlds and ancestors on behalf of the kingdom, that's all very much part and parcel of this exhibition. And people will be able to not only come and encounter what Maya kings, how they presented themselves, how they viewed the world, but also have an opportunity to really engage with those ideas as it plays out over the many centuries, even into contemporary day.
And Tony, let me go back to you and picking up on both of what Loa and Simon have said about time and the universe. And I wonder, whether a successful culture, and in many ways the Maya culture was successful in so many different ways for such a long period of time, whether that helped to create this notion about time and permanence and having a past and maybe even thinking about a future.
Well, the Maya were extraordinary when it came to the temporal computations, if you will, and they've always been mysterious to us with their cryptic writing and their amazing astronomy. They had a table that could follow the movement of Venus to an accuracy of one day in 500 years. They did it all in a jungle with low tech, and of course, our modern culture looks at that and begins to wonder, well, how could they do all that? And this is where I think aliens come into the picture, and we label our own, we graft our own romantic suppositions onto the Maya world. And so if you Google up Maya 2012, you'll find among the 50 million hits, connections with aliens who were here. And of course, as I said earlier, that whole biblical notion of the end of time grafted onto what Simon and Loa have suggested are our timeless cycles. But I'd like to add that the more likely interpretation, these cycles are not so different from our cycles, whether they're small or large. You know, we go through a kind of a reckoning of our past every time New Year's comes around, or even Mardi Gras, we could say, where we, well, of course, we party incessantly, and then the next day, what do? We make New Year's resolutions. Or if it's Mardi Gras down in the French Quarter, we go through the process of purification, which for the true believer would be getting ashes daubed onto your head. And I think these are the kinds of things that happen at the end of all cycles, and I rather read the record more metaphorically. It's no question that Maya time cycles are about power to the dynasty, but I think much of what we see written in the codices, these Maya books, of which very few survive, really deal with metaphoric representations of this whole business of cyclic time when going through reckoning with the past and purification and then continuing with a new cycle.
It sounds like you're saying it's really about a beginning. It might be the end of something, but it really is the beginning of something else.
Sure, it's a re-beginning. And what do we do on New Year's when we make those resolutions? Well, we say, I'm going to do better this year than I did last year. I'm going to give up this and I'm going to give up that. And, of course, most of us proceed to break these rules after a few days. But I think that's what all cycles consist of. And it can even be the Sunday night blues, you know, which I remember I always used to get because I'd have to start another week of school. And so whether it's the Sunday night blues or the millennium, I think that this is characteristic behavior in all cyclic time. And the Maya time certainly was cyclic. It just happens that one of the big units on the odometer of Maya time is about to turn over in just somewhat 251 days if you follow the countdown. But when that happens, we can be assured, at least as far as the Maya are concerned, that another cycle will begin and we'll try to do better. At least that's what they say.
Well, we are talking about the Maya culture and civilization, the Maya calendar, and our guests are Anthony Avini, the voice you just heard on the telephone, also with us here in our Philadelphia studios, Simon Martin and Loa Traxler, and we're opening up the phones at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours, a national pediatric healthcare system. Through prevention, intervention, education, and research, Nemours has made a promise to help kids reach their full potential. This promise is lived out daily at Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, offering advanced inpatient and outpatient care in more than 30 specialties. The same specialty care is also available in communities throughout the region at the Nemours Children's Clinic. More information at nemours.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We're hoping to end the spring membership campaign today, and we can do that if you make a pledge of support to WHYY. If you've never been a supporter, if your membership has lapsed, if you're new to WHYY or new to public radio, take that next step and call 1-888-345-9499. Again, that's 1-888-345-WHYY, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
Throughout the ages, mankind has communicated through the heartbeat of a drum and the spirit of a voice. May 10th through 13th, The Painted Bride presents Skins and Songs. Spoken Hand Percussion Orchestra meets Philip Hamilton's voices. This live music presentation highlights the strength and beauty of humanity when cultural diversity prevails. Two ensembles, 22 artists, and over 33 traditions merge together as one on stage. For tickets and info, paintedbride.org. The Painted Bride supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology is opening an exhibit this Saturday that explores the fascination with the Maya calendar and culture and our current and apparently very American obsession with end-of-world scenarios. And Maya 2012 runs through January 13th, 2013. We have three Maya experts who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios and on the telephone. Loa Traxler is Associate Deputy Director of the Penn Museum, curator of this Maya exhibit, and she is an archaeologist who has excavated at the site of Copan. Simon Martin, Associate Curator in the Penn Museum's American section. He's an ancient writing specialist, co-curator of this Maya exhibit, and on the telephone is Anthony Avini, and he's Russell Colgate Professor of Astronomy, Anthropology, and Native American Studies at Colgate University, and the author of a book called The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012, and we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Let me go back to you. We actually were talking during the break because I asked Anthony, you know, what made this Maya culture just so sophisticated, so advanced? The fact that they could track, you know, Venus in the sky tells us something about this culture. It's not Martians. It's not aliens. How were they able to create such an advanced culture?
Well, it's really one of the hallmarks of civilization in the Americas, a culture that really came together by 1500 BC that very quickly over the span of a few centuries had mastered their own environment and created towering cities in the tropical forest. They were able to really bring together long-distance trade. They were able to marshal their own kingdoms and populations to really carry out tremendous public works projects, construction, roadways, towering monuments and temples, all part and parcel of a worldview that really integrated the natural, supernatural, and the very terrestrial world that we all inhabit. And part of the story that of course, Maya 2012 brings together are so many of the factors of the natural environment and the human world that were all part of their worldview. So whether it was the deities that really underpinned Maya civilization, the rain god, storm gods, gods of lightning, or whether it was a keen interest and appreciation for commemorating and celebrating ancestors and their ongoing role in their own societies. Mm-hmm. All of those parts of an amazing cultural expression came together in what we think of as the classic Maya world from 200, 300 AD, clear through a tremendous florescence of the classic period up to 800 or 900 AD. And from that, we have, of course, examples of tremendous hieroglyphic writing, of very sophisticated mathematics, and as Tony, of course, specializes in, tremendous appreciation for the movements of celestial bodies and how all of this integrates into a very rich worldview. So it's an amazing American story. And of course, after there was tremendous political and economic and religious florescence, there were tremendous changes that occurred in 800 and 900. So the Maya went through a very important transformation that many people gloss as the collapse of Maya civilization. But in fact, it was just tremendous change and movements of populations and florescence of other parts of the Maya world that then gave rise to lots of different sites, of course the famous Chichen Itza and Mayapan, and transformations continued during a time when in fact the Maya experienced all kinds of challenges that came out of their own successes. They had tremendous populations that then overtaxed their environments. They experienced inter-kingdom politics, alliance, and warfare. They had tremendous challenges dealing with environmental change, even in their period. So there was it's a great story, and it's a cultural story that even continues after the encounter with Europeans and clear to our contemporary day with the republics of all these countries and the contemporary people who are still with us.
I want to get back to some of that, but Simon, let me get you back in on the conversation. Mm-hmm. As an ancient writing specialist, Loa actually said before the show began, world famous ancient writing specialist, what does the writing, I guess, of the Maya people, what does it tell us about the culture?
Well, it's the decipherment of Maya writing is sort of one of the big stories in the Americas, you know, in the past 30 years or so. I mean, there were clues, there were inklings, there was a general kind of understanding of some elements of things up until, say, the 1970s and 80s. But that's really when the dam broke, and increasingly we could take whole hieroglyphic inscriptions and understand what they're trying to tell us. So this is something remarkable. This is ancient American people speaking to us in their own words.
Right. And is it words, letters, numbers?
Sure. I mean, this is a full, complete writing system. So this would be completely comparable to Egyptian hieroglyphs or Hittite or cuneiform. It's very, very elaborate. Visually, it's sort of dauntingly complex. Lots of, you know, full figures intertwined with one another, one sign on top of another, fused together. And that's one of the reasons it's been such a challenge to unpick this kind of elaborate woven textile of writing.
Where do you go to, you know, to deconstruct it?
Well, this is the challenge. You know, I mean, all decipherments have to begin with sort of just tiny steps. And we had little clues left to us by the Spanish when they, you know, they were speaking to people who could still write with Maya hieroglyphs in the 16th century. But, of course, they were also involved in exterminating that culture, unlearning all those things and imposing the European way of doing things. So the writing system very quickly disappeared. But those clues, although it's taken a long time to actually understand, because the Spanish themselves didn't understand what they were being told. So now we've got to that stage. It's sort of begun to sort of explode in terms of knowing how the system works. And that's been very, very important to us.
Anthony Vini, let me get you back in on the conversation as well. And anything you want to add in terms of trying to understand the Maya writing and even its mathematics?
Well, one of the hardest parts to understand for us, Marty, is these amazing achievements in the astronomical sciences, and I attribute that to our being so tightly bound to technology that we can't imagine how a culture that didn't have telescopes or computers, much less iPads, could calculate the period of the moon, the phases of the moon, to an accuracy of 7 minutes. How could they do that? And it's questions like that first attracted me, having been trained as an astronomer, to Maya studies. They have these books called codices. They're really two sources of inscriptions, to follow up on Simon. The one are the monuments, which I think, as Lois suggests, have a lot to do with dynastic history, and then the writing in books. And there are only three books that survive. Bishop Landa, who tells us that we found books among these people in great number, but we burned them all because they contained the lies of the devil. Only three of these folded manuscripts survive. They're like accordion folded documents painted on the bark of the fig tree. And among them are these extraordinary tables that follow the motion of the moon. And I can tell you very briefly that, you know, it doesn't take technology to be able to deduce the accuracy of the phases of the moon to 7 minutes. Suppose you and I observe the next full moon, and then we decide, after we separate, to keep track of full moons and the number of days between them. And you might go off and tally 30 days for the next one. I might tally 29, because it's pretty hard to tell when the moon is full. The next full moon, you might place it 31 days later. I might place it 30, and then 30 for each of us the following, and so on. If we came back together in say 10 years and averaged out these intervals of 30s and 29s and 31s, which would correspond to these full moons, why, we'd come up with an answer of 29.5306 days, which is accurate to 7 minutes. So you see, it's persistence as well as repetition of naked eye observations that give us these kinds of accuracy. So indeed, studying Maya science gives us a really good idea of how we don't need technology to attain precise knowledge.
But obviously, you have to be observant. You have to care about the universe that you live in. You have to notice changes. You have to think that there's something different from day from night. I mean, these are all sort of obvious things. But
yeah, and I think, Marty, that you've got to have a bunch of guys who might be called Maya geeks, you know, who got so carried away with themselves that they maybe formed the Maya Institute of Advanced Studies and just did this stuff because they loved it.
And are there no girls in this institute?
Guys, well, you know, I use the guy term
today. I know,
today.
I'm just...
In a general
it is
sense.
2012, after all.
Forgive me for that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Anthony Avini. He joins us by telephone, along with Simon Martin and Loa Traxler. They're here with us in our Philadelphia studios. We are talking about Maya civilization and culture and the importance of the year 2012. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before we get to our callers, so I do want to talk about human sacrifice because, you know, you can't talk about the Maya without talking about human sacrifice. What was the importance of that, Loa?
Well, amongst the Maya, as with many other peoples in the Americas, human sacrifice really was fundamentally about offerings and blood sacrifice. So giving up of the essence of human life as part of various ritual celebrations. So, for example, Maya nobility would often give blood from their own bodies as part of ritual events. So if they were making offerings to particular deities or to commemorate certain ancestors, there might well be part of a ritual that involved drawing blood from tongues, earlobes, genitalia, etc., that was part of creating offerings of precious materials and essences that would then be involved in burning of incense and other offerings, all to create this amazing, magical, communicative smoke that would arise and be part of the surrounding context of ritual events. And so for the ancient Maya, as well as many Maya that were recorded in historical times, and many kinds of offerings that continue in very conservative traditional communities to this day, blood offering was really, it was an observance and an offering of the most precious of materials. So it was part and parcel, but very different from what some media outlets and Hollywood spectacles would like to convince us. I mean, it was very much a part of a bigger world of precious essences and substance, and very important and not to be trifled with and not to be exploited in the kind of, you know, spectacles that we are encouraged to think about from Hollywood.
Well, are you saying that, and I'll look at you and Simon, and then we'll get back to our codes, that there were not human sacrifices? I mean, people might offer, you know, some of their blood.
Well, no, I think it's fair to say that there were some human sacrifices,
okay.
But we're not talking about vast scales of, you know, the kind of like the movie Apocalypto. This is all fantasy. There's no archaeological evidence for any of it. And most of it really is trying to kind of import notions from the Aztec civilization and a series of things that have all been merged into a kind of pan-American kind of nonsense.
Here we go again, right? Let me get to Kyle from Thorndale to join our conversation. And Kyle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
I have a question for your guests. I've seen a lot of global conflicts kind of spark up here lately, and I've seen a lot of chips fall into place for possibly a nuclear bunker buster strike on Iran, and just a lot of buildup for global tension. I'm wondering if something like a World War III type of nuclear event happened, would it change their mind if that occurred on 2012? I would just say that maybe we are presented with a choice in 2012 to maybe finally stop war and Electron Paul. So thank you.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Well, part of what is so important for contemporary Maya is that in December of 2012, we begin a new cycle. And so it is a time of tremendous opportunity and a time, as Tony mentioned previously, of reflection and consideration. So contemporary Maya, who we speak with and who we've interviewed for the exhibition project, they are very straightforward that 2012 for them is mm-hmm. a time of optimism. It's a time to think of how they and we collectively have an impact in the world.
Yeah.
So while we can't, of course, relate all kinds of geopolitical events that come from our own social interactions, for the Maya, it's very much a part of renewal and looking forward. Mm-hmm. What matters to them, to their communities, the prospects yeah. for their kids, their role in their own country's politics, and how we consider Maya people and as part of very much our global world today. And they certainly would have opinions about any kind of impending elections and politics also.
Well, and let me pick up on Kyle's point and toss it to you, Anthony, because what we heard was his, finding some kind of coincidence here, taking events, pulling them together, and saying that somehow this is all connected. That seems to be an impulse that people have.
Well, I think it is, and we could add to Kyle's terrible Armageddon scenario, of course, the global economic collapse, global warming, the terrorism, the earthquakes, tsunamis. By the way, I think it's pretty clear from the study of these earth disasters, these earth-based geological disasters, that they are no more frequent now than they ever have been. The media only report on them with greater frequency. I mean, we have more sensitivity to reporting on them. As far as nuclear holocaust is concerned, well, if something good comes of all of this 2012 discussion, maybe we could heed the lesson of history and, think a little bit more about how we could work together to prevent these things. I think it's interesting the way the New Age culture taps into this. The perpetrators, if you will, of all of these things are going to happen, predicting what's going to happen, are clearly dissatisfied with the course of Western culture, with capitalism, with industrialism and expansionism. They don't like the techno world, and they're anti-science because they think that the science is out to demystify nature. And so they are the ones who get attracted to some of these connections that really don't have any scientific basis. But as I say, the good that can come out of this is maybe we'll be more aware of these things. Of course, I rather doubt that. I'm kind of cynical and pessimistic.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I share that kind of optimism. But let me turn to you, Simon, about a minute before our second break here, and not to add to the catastrophizing, but climate change, it's important to understand climate change and what happened to Maya civilization.
Well, the collapse that Loa referred to, sometime after 800, there was a mass abandonment of all the greatest Maya cities. They fell into ruin, they were taken over by the jungle, and effectively when Maya civilization was rediscovered in the 19th century, they had lain there abandoned for some 600 years. So that is a story that we've been trying to unravel. We've been trying to understand whether it's from the inscriptions or whether it's from archaeological remains and increasingly from looking at the way that climate is laid down in lake sediments, within cave materials. So that story that's beginning to come out of that seems to be fairly consistent that there were some serious droughts towards the end of that period. It's still a little bit muddy. There's more data coming in all the time. But certainly a society that lived ecologically on the edge in the way that they did. I mean, this was not an environment that was very suited to large populations. It's very dry. There's not much topsoil. So it was a tough environment to make a great living.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break, talking about the Maya culture today on Radio Times and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and announces the launch of My Fox Chase, a web portal providing secure online communications and access to vital medical information. Fox Chase patients now have immediate 24/7 access to lab results and appointment schedules and can send secure messages to their healthcare team. Physicians can refer patients online and can be kept apprised of patients' progress. More about My Fox Chase at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
I'm Marty Moscoen. We want to end this membership campaign today just as much as you do. We go on the air a few times a year to remind you about the important role you play in supporting WHYY and the many programs that you hear every day. What is that worth to you? Pick up a phone and make a pledge of support right now. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org. Thanks so much.
The Philadelphia Speakers Series, presented by Widener University, returns to the Kimmel Center for the 2012-13 season. Seven engaging and thought-provoking evenings with some of the world's most interesting people, sharing their fascinating behind-the-headlines stories, and including a special guest speaker you won't want to miss. More information on the complete lineup of speakers is available at PhiladelphiaSpeakersSeries.org, sponsored by WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about Maya civilization, Maya culture, and the Maya calendar. And there is a lot of back and forth this year because of the Maya calendar. The year-long creation cycle ends in December, and some conspiracy theorists are predicting some form of apocalypse at the end of the year, although our guests and other Maya scholars say that this calendar is more about beginnings and endings. I should add the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology launching an exhibit this Saturday. It runs through the year into January about Maya calendar, Maya culture, and Maya civilization, and we have three Maya experts with us on Radio Times. Loa Traxler, Associate Deputy Director of the Penn Museum and Curator of this new Maya exhibit. Simon Martin is Associate Curator in the Penn Museum's American Section and Ancient Writing Specialist, Co-Curator of this Maya exhibit. And on the telephone, Anthony Avini, Russell Colgate Professor of Astronomy, Anthropology, and Native Studies Native American Studies at Colgate University, wrote a book called The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Loa, picking up on what Simon was saying before the break about this theory that it was drought, or perhaps even this Maya civilization that had the seeds of its own collapse.
Well, and that's, of course, as Simon mentioned, one of those real mysteries, if you will, about what happened with this tremendously successful civilization that really had come to a full fluorescence during the classic period. And so by 800, 900, 1000 AD, things had really changed. And so politically, their system of divine kings leading enormous expansive kingdoms in the tropical forest, that had met its limits. They had, in many kingdoms, really outtaxed their regional environments. There were all kinds of strains and stresses on the political machinations between kingdoms. And also, as Simon mentioned, it was coinciding with a time when, in the long-term rain cycles throughout the Central America and the Caribbean, we see now, through climatological evidence, real clear indications that in this area of Central America and the Yucatan of Mexico, they experienced some significant, serious, multi-year droughts. And for an agricultural society completely dependent on rainfall to replenish water systems, whether it's surface water, rivers, and cisterns, without recurring and predictable rainfall, all of these different communities were in times of real strain. So issues that came about from maximal populations and tremendous interactions amongst kingdoms really hit the skids when there was no rainfall, and all of the kinds of ritual events and political pageantry that was involved in the kings maintaining their kingdoms, all of that began to come into question when you had short rainfall. You had populations in distress. You had people who were genuinely suffering in 800, 900, 1000 AD.
Sounds like a cautionary tale.
Indeed. And so part of what we now see from the transformations that Maya civilization experienced is that Maya people, ancient and modern, were tremendously resilient and adaptive and could really take challenging circumstances and make from that tremendously changed but very positive kinds of cultural settings mm-hmm. for their communities. So it's a story that's really about the resilience of a society in the Americas.
You want to add to that, Tony Avini?
Yeah, well, I mean, as a result of that that depopulation and malnutrition and, you know, ceasing to build great architecture, the Maya also lost their writing skills and their calendrical skills, and they began to keep track of dates, not in terms of this fabulous long count, this cycle that's overturning, and all the detail that came with it, but rather, well, maybe dealing with statements like on Friday the 13th or Wednesday the next full moon. And so we have a difficult time putting the chronology together. So the great classical period of the Maya was over, and all we have to connect then with them are these Spanish people who come over and contact the New World, who don't have the vaguest idea of what that writing was about, nor did the people who were then living in the contemporary Maya area. And so the whole story of decipherment, as Simon sketched out, is a wonderful recovery of this lost knowledge that all happened really in the last two generations, and I think that puts the Maya front and center, you know, to deal with in terms of mysteries that abound. And so the popular culture latches onto that with the calendar overturning and with the Maya decipherment and with the tourism. So there are a lot of people that are going to be heading south come next December for big star parties and other gatherings mm-hmm. at the ruins, hoping to be in the right place, you know, to collect the cosmic energy, unless cosmophobia wins out and we get destroyed by a flying asteroid.
And Tony, will you be there?
I absolutely will be. I'm going to my favorite place, which is Uxmal, and I'm going to just take in the environment. I've got more interested since I've been studying the calendar in the people who are awed by the calendar. Mm-hmm. So I'm almost becoming a sociologist of Maya studies.
Add that to your resume.
My questionable repertoire. Yeah.
Let me go to you, Simon. Then I'll get back to our callers. One thing I was reading about, I guess the language or even the numbers, is that it's a numerical system based on the number 20. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're very set in our 10 fingers, our digits. That gives us base 10.
Right. And I was thinking about that actually.
Yeah, we tend to think that that's the only way of counting. Well, the Babylonians actually counted in base 60, and the Maya in base 20.
Fingers and toes?
Fingers and toes. So this is was fundamental to things. I mean, there's a kind of silly anecdote. There's no way of knowing whether it's true or not. That when the Spanish first came, because the Maya, one of their many inventions was cigarettes. Cigarettes fundamentally come from the Maya area. Well, apparently the Spanish were trading in them in little bundles of 20. And surprise, surprise, to this day, we're still trading in cigarettes in units of 20. So maybe
not.
There's a tiny trace of Maya civilization still with us today.
But you're saying it was based largely on this, on the number 20.
Yeah,
the,
20
as,
was
as
a,
we understand it.
Yeah, there was a series of magical numbers. You know, 13 had great importance.
Yeah.
3 was very important. 9 was very important.
Oh, interesting. Right.
And they kind of recur in various kind of cycles and various kinds of ways.
Tony, you want to add something?
Well, the Maya were rather Pythagorean, I think, about the way they dealt with numbers. You know, Pythagoras once said there is geometry in the humming of the strings, and what he meant, as any musician would be familiar with, is that when you pluck strings that are of length and the ratio of small whole numbers, you get consonant chords, you get harmony. And the Maya were really into this principle of harmony, and they took that number 20 and the 9 and the 13 and built up bigger and bigger cycles. But the cycles they chose to build up were what I would call commensurate, that is to say they related to one another in the ratio of whole numbers. So it kind of makes you wonder about whether we humans might all be wired to deal with the same principles. For example, the cycle of Venus takes 584 days. And that resonates in perfect harmony with the length of our 365-day year and the ratio of 5 to 8. So there's a 5-8 rhythm to that. And the Maya took that rhythm and built it all the way up to Bactuns and Katuns and so on. And their whole calendar, I think, was once characterized a long time ago by the eminent Mayanist Sir Eric Thompson as the process of building up bigger cycles from smaller ones, cycles that fit together perfectly.
Wow. Let me get, looks like Andy from Ewing to join us on Radio Times. And Andy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning to you all. I had a question about the calendar and wondering in the classic Mayan age, what sort of daily importance to and effect on the general agrarian, presumably illiterate population spread out as it was around these city centers this calendar actually had?
The idea of what kind of influence it had over daily life?
Well, the codices pretty much tell the story here because these are books about ritual procedures that are to take place on very specific names of days of the year, names and numbers of days of the year. And one can imagine the daykeeper going around from village to village with the codex tucked under his or her arm, answering questions such as, will my crops come in on time this year? Will there be a drought? Will my sister give birth to a healthy child? And so on. So these common everyday interests are there. And people would be advised to do certain things on certain days, when to offer tortilla, when to offer turkey. A colleague of mine who works down in Guatemala tells the story of a young man who wanted to propose to his sweetheart and was told that it's only on the day one monkey that you can do that, number one day monkey.
I'll remember that.
And that's it. And that day doesn't come around for 260 days. Well, he got very nervous about proposing on the eve of that day, that he went out and got very drunk and didn't wake up at all the next day. And he was told by the local timekeeper or daykeeper that he'd have to wait 259 more days to propose. So these are very precise, timed rituals, many of them agrarian, that the Maya had to adhere to.
Thanks for the call, Andy. Let me go to you, Loa, before we get back to our callers here, because you've been working in Copan, which I understand is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and I've seen photographs of it. I've never been there, although I'm totally intrigued. What kind of work are you doing there?
Well, we have been involved in excavations in Copan on behalf of the Penn Museum for many years. Our excavations wrapped up in 2003, but since that time we've continued to work with our colleagues and with the Honduran government to complete the analyses of all the amazing archaeological finds and to really work on publishing a tremendous wealth of research that came out of a large project focused at Copan with our many colleagues and to really bring that to the public. So this exhibition project at the Penn Museum is a real opportunity to bring together and to bring to a Philadelphia audience and a national audience the amazing material information that came from those excavations. So the breakthroughs, as Simon mentioned, in how we understand the individual biographies and the histories that come from the ancient Maya world, a big part of that story has come from excavations that we've been involved with at Copan. So whether it's the World Heritage Site of Copan or a similar World Heritage Site in Tikal, where the Penn Museum worked in the 50s and 60s, these are amazing locations that really give everyone an opportunity to come and experience the classic Maya world. Right. And also they're very much a part of the contemporary economies and politics in Central American countries and southern Mexico today. So in all these different places, the kinds of calendar observations that Tony was alluding to, those are very much part of how contemporary Maya people visit their own cultural heritage sites. So at Copan, at Tikal, at other locations in the highlands of Mexico and Guatemala, contemporary Maya people continue to celebrate their ancestors, their cultural heritage, with regular ceremonies that take place that tie in to the 260-day calendar that Tony mentioned. That's the sacred calendar that out of all of the systems that the classic Maya used, that calendar continues to be observed and to inform activities of people to this day in very traditional communities.
And we're talking about Maya culture, civilization, calendar with Loa Traxler, Simon Martin and Anthony Avini. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Oscar from West Philadelphia to join us. And Oscar, go ahead. You're on the air.
Sure. I just have a real quick question.
Sure.
I'm concerned about how the European archaeology world rehashes information, and it's sort of like what we see with Egyptology and things like that. So I'm wondering if this exhibit is going to represent authentic Mayan voices, or will it just be Europeans telling the story of Mayans as best as they think they have it.
Fair enough, Oscar. Let me give Simon Martin a chance to weigh in on that.
Well, that's a really good point, and I think that archaeology today is a lot more conscious about the fact that we're working in living countries, living communities, and very often with the descendants of the societies that we're studying. And very much in this show, we are addressing those issues. We have a series of Maya people who are appearing on video. You'll be able to ask them questions about their lives, about 2012, you know, all of these things. And they're there, you know, representing their communities, the separate ethnic traditions. Very often in the highlands, they have particular textiles which identify them. And people who live very much in the modern age, Maya archaeologists, who are involved in the study of their own history. So, yeah, it's a very good question.
Not just Europeans or
Anglos? No, it's not just Europeans. No. Not at all.
You want to add to that?
Well, and that's one of the pieces of that we felt quite strongly about for this exhibition project, that it really incorporate not only the viewpoints of museum professionals and Maya scholars of great standing, but as part of that enterprise, Maya people today have a real part of managing and presenting their cultural heritage. They have strong held views and traditions that are very much a part of this exhibition mm-hmm. project. And so, as Simon mentioned, visitors will be able to really hear directly from Maya people, Maya individuals who present themselves and how they see their communities, women who work with their cultural traditions in textiles and other arts, men who represent both the archaeological practice on the ground today. All these folks have real strong ideas and real optimism for their heritage and mm-hmm. how they are committing themselves to passing on their cultural traditions to their kids and their communities. So all of that is part of this exhibition project, and I think people really have a chance to hear directly from Maya people in this exhibit, and hopefully that'll open up conversations when they encounter Maya people in many places here in the U.S.
Maybe even in the supermarket. Well, Loa Traxler and Simon Martin and Anthony Avini, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, talking about the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology exhibition, Maya 2012, and it opens on Saturday, runs through the middle of January of 2013. I'm Marty Moscowane, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Thank you so much for joining us.